This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic.
Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
It's a big warning. Australia's spy agency boss saying we're facing unprecedented security threats and that there has been more terrorism planned for Australia since Bondi that's been stopped. And he's saying some things need to change. So what exactly is he talking about? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to tell you what the ASIO boss has said. Later, our long listener of the week, we're going to hear from two young First Nations Australians that are so worried about the future of their culture, lands, waterways, that they're taking their complaint to the United Nations.
It is a bit scary, but also at the same time, it's a necessary step in action that we've had to take.
Yeah, that chat coming up very soon. First though,
Hack.
In case you missed it, Australia has a new political party.
On Triple J.
Yeah, you might have seen these headlines. Getting around this morning, this afternoon, we're getting a new political party. A lot of speculation for the past few days especially. It was confirmed by Independents Allegra Spender and Zali Steggall. They announced this morning we're starting Community Strong Australia. At this point, it's just them. None of the other independents have signed up. And there are a lot of questions about this. So let's dive in and get some answers. Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender from Community Strong Australia, welcome to Hack.
Thanks for having us.
It sounds good.
Why are you doing this, I guess, is the first question. What has prompted this new political movement?
Look, I think that people really feel politically homeless at the moment. I think Australia's at a real crossroads where people feel like the major parties are just not there for them. They don't understand things. But there's this push to extremism, and I know a lot of people are also really concerned about division. And so people go, look, I don't know where to go. I don't know who can actually represent the issues that matter to me, to my friends. Politics seems so out of touch. We really want to respond to that need to try and give people a community-led representation.
We're at a crossroads in Australia where you've got, unusually, a government with a supermajority. You have a coalition lurching to the right, no centrist party, and you have this rise of the far-right movement. And a lot of people feel disaffected, and issues are lingering, right? Especially for young people, that question around housing affordability, the kind of climate debt they are inheriting, the impact on the environment and their future, the level of debt and opportunity, the cost of getting trained, you know, hex debts, all these issues are impacting so many people. And there's just this real frustration.
Who are you targeting here? Like, is it one specific type of voter? Are you hoping that maybe you'll be able to claw back some of the voters who could be drifting to parties like One Nation?
Look, I think it's not just one voter. I mean, both Zali and I in our communities are supported by a range of voters. When you talk to them, they, you know, people tell me that they've pretty much voted across the spectrum. Like, you know, people want to live in a society where you feel like you're looking after each other, but they also want to live in a society where there's opportunity, and where you can build and grow businesses.
Yeah, I think trust in politics is at an all-time low, and I think the major parties have contributed to that, because for too many Australians, they see politics as lobbyists, vested interest, not really linked or listening to communities and not responding to what ordinary Australians want to see.
Are you worried you're going to lose some of the edge that maybe comes with being an independent? Because there is this perception out there, especially among young people, that maybe independents can be a little more rogue, they can say whatever they want, have bold ideas. Like, are you worried that people might see you a little differently if you're in this party setting?
Well, we've been really clear in designing a constitution for Community Strong that I think preserves the best of being an independent, which is the free vote, that we all MPs as members of Community Strong can vote for their community, and we will work collectively, collaboratively together, but we still have that independence and freedom when it comes to the vote. Now, even without a party structure, Allegra and I have probably voted about 90% of the time together, because we have values aligned.
If you're not going to have a unified party position on issues, though, won't it be chaos? Like, isn't there some chance that you're going to massively disagree on an issue and it's not going to work?
Look, I think we, as Zali said, we already vote together on about 90% of issues. And I think
that's about that 10% though?
No, I know, but it's, you know, normal people disagree a bit. And I think actually people want you to be authentic. You know, we do represent different communities and our communities are different. And so I think actually what people want you to do is build on the common ground. And there's a heap of common ground between Zali and I and everything we've been doing. So we will build on that common ground. We will build our policy positions on the most important issues on that common ground. But you know, you still retain that ability, you know, to vote for your community. And I think that means you can be authentic, because nothing is worse than watching one of those politicians literally spout the lines that they have been told to spout. And you know, particularly when I know I've spoken to them about it and they don't believe what they're saying. And when you don't believe what you're saying, it comes through. So I think this is trying to build something that is still authentic, which is still grounded in community, but is also organised and really purposeful.
There's a lot of reaction coming through on the text line now. Someone's saying it won't last. It's just a matter of how long. Okay, not too much optimism there from someone who's messaged in. Davo in Newcastle saying, let's not lose sight of the fact that these Teals hold small L Liberal seats. And Andrew saying, I don't understand why they didn't join the Greens. I thought they had a lot in common. Maybe not that much in common, Andrew. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with politicians Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender, the independents who've launched a political party. It's called Community Strong Australia. Zali, Allegra, let's go to a question a lot of listeners are asking, the elephant in the room here. I mean, who is coughing up the money? Who is funding this?
It is members of our communities. We are not linked to any other organisation. I have been re-elected with donations from my community, and I have a lot, obviously before launching this, have sought feedback and consultation from my community and volunteers. If I can do a plug, go to communitystrong.org.au. We will need this.
Because I'll be honest, like, we haven't actually raised much money. We're actually getting started. We literally have just started the website.
Because people are asking, Simon Holmes a Court, Climate 200, is that behind this movement?
Not at all.
Okay, what about Scott Farquhar, Mike Cannon-Brookes, any billionaires?
No.
Well, not as yet, but my invitation to them is if they believe in our policy pillars and our values and, you know, believe in sensible economic management, climate action, integrity and equality, and they are in a position to support that, then that's great. I mean, you can't begrudge people that have capacity to support improving our democracy, being able to do that. Now, but what we've got to be really clear is that does not buy influence. There's no party line. There's no party power brokers. And that's the difference. In comparison, if you look at One Nation, you know, the support and clear influence that Gina Rinehart has on their policies, it's clear what influence that support is buying. I think for people, it's also important to remember the major parties did, you know, stitch up the game in terms of donation reform laws and spent campaign spending law changes that very much embed advantage for major parties over individuals.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, critics are saying this is a way of getting around seat-based spending and donation caps that were passed by Labor and the Coalition last year. What do you say to that?
Look, I say, I think at the first point, what we're trying to do is grow the movement. And I think you need to have, if you want to run in the Senate, you need to have a party. That's actually just the rules. We do want to run in the Senate. We think that more community sort of driven senators would be a good thing because they're really, you know, the Senate's a really important house of review. I know from being an independent starting out, it's really overwhelming. It's really, really hard to get started, even, you know, even without sort of the changes to donation laws, because you just have to do so much by yourself from the ground up. And so I think this is an opportunity for us to help people. Now, you know, I don't think the donation laws are a good thing, I'll be honest, because I think they really tilt the balance back to the major parties. But to be honest, they might still be overturned by the High Court anyway. We don't actually know where the donation laws are going to end up because they're currently being contested. But we just wanted to do this because, frankly, politics as usual is not working.
Why do you think it is that others on the crossbench haven't been keen to jump on board with this idea? Because we spoke with Senator David Pocock earlier this week and he said from his perspective it wasn't happening. Are you disappointed with that? Like, are you worried that the other independents haven't wanted to jump on?
No, we completely respect that for many independents there needs to be that consultation with their communities. And by launching today, the constitution is now public and that gives them that blueprint to consult with their communities and their volunteers on. Now, we've worked really collaboratively with other independents, but also with David. We'll continue to do that, and we hope they are allies if they choose not to join, that they continue as allies on so many policy areas. Keep in mind, David Pocock is a political party for his election in the Senate for the ACT.
Yeah, and this is just about being a complement. I think that we can really, you know, whether or not other independents come on board, I think what we can do is really complement the work that's been done.
A lot of questions around this today I've seen. Who's the boss of this party?
There's no boss. How many times do we have to say this?
It's quite interesting. I mean, at the moment we're a team of two, so I think it's fair to say we are a team. Look, if you look in business and in a lot of areas, actually your strengths come from unity as a team, and too often the focus is on the idea that there's one person calling the shots instead of really thinking about it of what are the strengths that each person brings to the table to make it a stronger team.
Business now, partnerships break up all the time, though, because of issues around people not getting along, you know?
Look, I think Zali and I have been working together for the last 4 years, and I think we get on pretty well. And then honestly, like, you know, we've got in the Constitution that if we get to 10, then we'll look at a leadership structure. But, like, let's get going. Like, let's start.
There are other ideas out there to try to win support in the centre. Like, we spoke with Charlotte Mortlock earlier this year, who launched a Something Better campaign with the hope of getting a political party up and running in the future. Is she part of this?
Not at this point. But I think the fact that she started that movement shows the desire and appetite for something new, and the fact that we have had such a limited range. And look, two-party politics isn't great for democracy, right? You look at what's happening in the US, there is so little choice. It polarises communities and creates huge division. So people are looking for those options. And how do we do things differently? And a lot of times people can't imagine doing it differently until you're doing it, and then all of a sudden you realise it can be done. On your question of leadership is all too often wrapped up with questions, I think, of power and questions of ego. And I think for good governance, we actually need to keep that outside and actually focus on working together and finding solutions. We won't agree on everything, but the point is finding our common ground.
Allegra Spender and Zali Stegel from Community Strong Australia, really appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks so much.
And still so many messages coming through on this. Someone saying, look, I think Zali's, you know, speech that she made when she got into Parliament is a bit contradictory of what she's saying now. Another person saying, I've campaigned for Allegra twice. I'm so hopeful that Community Strong is going to work. They're both intelligent, well-supported and well-connected people. And someone else saying, bring in Stephen Bradbury, he'll get them over the line, while the others trip over each other. We might talk about this a bit more on the shake-up tomorrow.
Hack.
Our top spy boss says he's worried an Australian will one day be killed by a foreign government here at home.
On Triple J.
Yeah, big warning from the head of Australia's spy agency. Security threats facing Australia are increasing, he says. But since the Bondi terror attack last year, there have been more terror plots, but thankfully they've been prevented. But the top spy boss says there are some things that need to change, as Evelyn Manfield reports from Canberra.
The country's spy chief has delivered a dramatic annual address.
The security threats facing Australia are growing in number and complexity.
I do worry that one day an Australian will be killed at the hands of a foreign government here in Australia.
It's a harrowing assessment from ASIO, which is Australia's spy agency.
We face an unprecedented number of threats and an unprecedented cumulative level of harm.
That's ASIO boss Mike Burgess giving his yearly update on the threats Australia faces. It's also his first one since the shooting at Bondi last year. Since then, the agency's been facing serious questions about its funding of counter-terrorism, which he defended.
It continued to grow in the months before Bondi. Resourcing followed the threat.
He also said since Bondi, 14 significant terror-related cases were prevented. And separately to that, in the last 12 years, the security agency has foiled 31 major terrorism plots.
If not found and checked, it could have led to a mass casualty event, and obviously that's bad.
Recently, ASIO's had a big focus on anti-Semitic attacks and foreign actors like Iran. You might remember these cases from 2024.
A cafe in Bondi went up in flames early this morning.
Three hooded men broke into the Adas Israel synagogue, dousing it in fuel before setting it alight.
Last night, Mike Burgess revealed that the attack at the Jewish kitchen was actually coordinated by an Australian citizen living in Iran and working as a senior agent with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And the firebombing at the synagogue, that was directed by someone who used to live in Australia and was recruited by the IRGC.
Thankfully, no one died as a result of these arson attacks.
Australia's threat level currently sits at probable, but Burgess said that doesn't accurately capture the threat and suggested the rating system could be overhauled. The government and opposition have backed that in.
If the framework around how we deal with terror-related matters need revisiting, then let's do that as a matter of urgency.
Over recent months and even years, a lot has been said about the need for politicians and media to use less heated language because of fears it can further stoke division. Mike Burgess repeated that message today.
By all means, protest, but be careful how you protest. For the media, certainly continue to do your job, but be careful how you do your job. The clickbait model of media these days, no offence to anyone, but those headlines drive anger, and actually when you see people get angry, there is a direct correlation in these modern times between anger and language, inflamed tension and violence.
While he wasn't specifically referring to this, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke today did raise concerns about Channel 9 host Karl Stefanovic interviewing a far-right British extremist on his new podcast.
The last thing we need in Australia is for the temperature to be raised by people who want to spread hatred being given a louder voice.
Tommy Robinson is considered one of the most divisive anti-immigration voices in the United Kingdom, who's helped mobilise support for anti-migrant riots.
He was banned by Scott Morrison and Peter Dutton. They knocked back a visa for him. He certainly won't get a visa under me.
During the interview, Stefanovic said he admired his guest's tenacity and courage in standing up for what he believes is right. Now, the TV host's job with Channel 9 is expected to end.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there. All right, we're going to move on to our long listen of the week.
Hack.
Not telling the whole truth, full truth, the hard truth about Australia's contribution doesn't change the truth, and history will remember that.
On Triple J.
Yeah, really interesting case has been making headlines this week. I don't know if you've seen it. A group of 10 Australians lodging a complaint with the United Nations Human Rights Committee over Australia's coal and gas exports. Now, this is the first complaint case of its kind to go to the UN since the world's highest court ruled that countries do have a legal obligation to protect the climate and to prevent harm to the climate. So will it lead to anything? Well, Pam and Letitia Francis are Narunga, Narungeri and Kaurna women from South Australia, and they're part of this action. They say the impacts of an algal bloom there have been devastating for their culture. So let's learn a little more now with Pam and Letitia. Welcome to Hack.
Thanks for having us.
Letitia, I might start with you in this chat. Can you explain a little bit about this case, like what exactly you're accusing the Australian government of?
Yeah. So this case is a group of 10 regular everyday people coming together to talk about their experiences with the climate crisis, whether that be through flood, bushfire, the algal bloom in our case. And we're coming together to ask the Albanese government to stop exporting coal and gas and also stop allowing new mines to be open here in Australia, because we have a responsibility to protect us as everyday people, and they're failing that responsibility right now.
Letitia, you're studying marine science, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm studying a Bachelor of Science in Wildlife and Marine Conservation Biology.
And so the algal bloom stuff you're particularly interested in, not just because it's impacting your personal life, but you can sort of understand what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, when the algal bloom first started, it was really interesting to be in a classroom in a university setting, because a lot of the time, like, the algal bloom did come up on numerous occasions. There was a lot of our professors saying, like, they don't know how the ecosystem will ever recover from this. And that's so distressing from a First Nations perspective as well, because it was so much more than just the environment, I suppose, to me, having such a close connection to country, hearing them say that it might not ever recover is just, it was absolutely heartbreaking sitting in that type of an environment and then wondering what will be of my community and my people.
Can you tell us a bit about the role country has played in your childhood and growing up?
We are always on country, a little less now. The algal blooms on and we have extreme heat.
And what sort of stuff are you doing there and are you being taught on country? Like for people who don't understand, you're talking about the disruption that the algal bloom has had on your connection with country. So what kind of stuff are you missing out on?
This is just one example. Our community does a butterfish competition every year where young men and, you know, even our senior elder men go out and do our traditional practices of catching butterfish. And, yeah, we haven't been able to hold that. And also when they bring the butterfish back, you know, the young girls learn how to cook and do all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, we're missing out on that and haven't been able to do that. And brothers haven't been able to learn any of that. So, yeah, it's really, really sad.
So are you worried, both of you, that basically that people aren't, the young ones especially, aren't going to learn these skills because they just don't have access to the waterways like they should?
That's definitely a real fear, that the younger generation isn't going to be able to do these things and they're not going to have that part of country to be a part of. And our old people that pass down this knowledge and that we learn from aren't going to be around forever. And unfortunately, whilst the algal bloom's been on, we have lost members of our community that did hold knowledge and we just aren't going to be able to get that knowledge back. The country that we had as children has changed so much. I remember just being able to spend the whole summer out during school holidays with our grandfather and we'd go jumping off the jetty and just spending every waking minute in the water with him. And our younger siblings don't have that opportunity now because of the algal bloom. And the fear is that he will pass away before this passes and then they don't have those memories or that experience or the knowledge that gets taught by that country.
Mm-hmm. The way our people pass knowledge is by being on country and immersed in country and you know, the right time to share those stories. And at the moment with, you know, the current crisis of the climate, we don't actually get many of those opportunities and time where it is right to share and pass down knowledge and stories. You know, a lot of our time at the moment is talking about how do we keep our people safe. It's really sad, and I suppose that's another reason why we're on this case, is because we can't do this by ourselves and alone, and we need the people in charge to step up and help.
I want to ask, when you noticed that something wasn't right, like in terms of this algal bloom, when was stuff a bit different?
Elders, they noticed, you know, that our oceans weren't looking quite right and were sick well before anyone else did, and, you know, told us, hey, stay away from there. You know, let's figure out what's going on before we go and get in there and do our stuff, because, you know, they could tell that it was sick. And, you know, we spent a lot of time down at the beach and on our country, and we went down there and it was just, it smelt funny and there was just thick foam and you know, a beautiful, beautiful blue water just was grey and green and not very nice, and sand was sticking to us. We come away with rashes and it was just terrible.
There was just dead fish and sea animals all across the beach, like, and it smelt, stinks, and for k's and k's and k's, just hundreds of dead sea animals. It was also like a ghost town. There was no one there, which is so strange. It just felt like everything was dead.
Did the older people tell you whether something like this had happened before? Like, have they said this is something they haven't seen?
This was something that none of them had ever seen before. This was not normal. And it was so distressing to hear that from our old people and then for the Australian government. Because when the algal bloom first started, we got so many mixed messages from the Australian government about what to do, what was okay. The Australian government was saying, oh, no, it's totally fine to be near the water. And then our old people were like, no, stay away from the water. Like, you're going to get sick. And then following that, the Australian government actually came back with saying, oh, no, stay away from the water, like you will get sick. We were getting the message from our elders in our community, which is what we followed. But then the South Australian government was sending a whole nother message, and it was just such a confusing time.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Pam and Letitia Francis. They and a group of other Australians are taking a complaint to the United Nations saying that the Australian government is not doing enough to protect them from climate change. Pam and Letitia, your complaint calls for Australia to end its coal and gas exports. There might be some people listening now who are wondering, is it fair to link those exports with, you know, that devastating algal bloom that you're experiencing now? What do you say to that?
No matter where Australia is exporting their coal and gas around the world, it can still come back in the form of climate impacts here on Australian
soil.
And
it does.
It does. And we've seen that in the algal bloom and increased bushfires, and all of the other claimants that are on this case as well have experienced that. And they can be linked through scientific research to the climate crisis.
When people hear about climate change, they genuinely think of, you know, these big impacts that are happening, it getting hotter and that sort of stuff. But, you know, there is everyday life that is being impacted. And if they really, you know, looked at it, they would probably also realise that they are being impacted by climate change. And I think that says a lot.
Pam, Letitia, the government is saying, look, it's investing a lot in renewable energy. It's got climate targets. It's saying that, you know, there's got to be this balance between climate action and having a safe, reliable energy supply. What would be your response to that?
We're not asking the Australian government to completely cut off what they're doing right now in this moment. We know the impacts that will have on everyday Australians and what that looks like. We're asking them to stop making new mines and giving more to the issue that we're all facing. We want them to take responsibility for what's happening and create a just transition so that no one gets left behind.
How does it feel to be part of something so big, like to be going to the United Nations and to be joining up with other people from across the country? Was that like a scary thought at first?
It is a bit scary. But also at the same time, it's a necessary step in action that we've had to take. Myself in particular, I don't and haven't felt heard by the Albanese government. So yes, although it was a little bit scary at first, I realised, you know, how important it is that we take this step. And to be honest with you, we're not trying to divide anyone or anything. We are trying to work together because that's what it's going to take to come up with these solutions that we need.
This time, it feels like all of them are very receptive. Previously, though, it hasn't felt like that. And unfortunately, that is why we've had to go to the UN, because a lot of us have tried to reach out to our local members and have tried to advocate. And we just don't feel like we were being heard by the Australian government and the Albanese government in what our needs are and how to move forward.
Pam and Letitia, there'd be a lot of young Australians listening to you now who'd be pretty impressed and like inspired by what you're doing and maybe looking up to you. How does that feel?
Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking sometimes, but I always think, you know, I also look up to a lot of young people, and I think, you know, our young ones are getting the courage and strength to do what's right. But it's a little less nerve-wracking knowing that, you know, I am doing what's right for my people and community. So
it's such a great privilege to be able to be that type of a person for a young person. Yeah, like Pam said, it is nerve-wracking and it does apply a lot of pressure. But we are still learning, very much so, and we're just telling our story. And every other young person that would potentially be listening can know that, like, there is so much value in their lived experience as a young person, and no one else before them have had to deal with nearly as much climate crisis as what they're going through. You know, the increased bushfires, the floods, like, they aren't alone in how they're feeling, and their voice is so valuable to this fight.
Pam and Letitia Francis, really appreciate you speaking with us on Hack.
Yeah, and thank you for having us here and listening to our stories.
And we have some messages coming through, someone saying it's really upsetting how little people care about the continuation of practicing culture and being on country. It's important for everyone to care to preserve our beautiful land. I'm not Aboriginal, but I respect how First Nations people care for their country that we're lucky to be part of. Yeah, Hack did reach out to the government about this complaint to the UN, and a spokesperson got back to us in a statement saying Australia takes its international human rights law obligations very seriously and engages in good faith with human rights treaty bodies. All right, and if you do want to listen to the full interview, go and check out Hack's podcast, because every week we've got long listens dropping and we've got deep dives on the weekend, all sorts of stuff. And go leave us a review. Let us know how you're enjoying all that stuff, because it helps us decide which voices we hear, what kind of content we bring you. So let us know there. That is all for Hack for now.